Good morning. Welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM in Toronto. I'm Phil Taylor, your host, and we are going to be speaking today with Professor Atif Kabursi, Emeritus Professor at McMaster in Economics. And I believe the professor is on the line. Are you there, Atif Kabursi?
Yes, I am.
Thank you very much for joining us. You are an authority on the region that is currently worrying the entire world. Just as a backdrop, I mean, we've had this exchange of combat attacks by two major powers, the United States and Israel, on the Islamic Republic. And the Islamic Republic seemed to hold its own. It fired back at both. And now we've gone into a kind of a period of on-again, off-again violence. But the country of Lebanon somehow is at the center of the disagreements. It's certainly a factor in trying to determine whether there's going to be a ceasefire because, as my understanding, and I'll be asking you to explain it, but that the agreement is supposed to include Israel's ceasing its attacks on Lebanon and also withdrawal. And this, I think we need to understand, how did Lebanon come to be at the center of the of this really dangerous exchange between three powers?
Well, absolutely, Phil. Lebanon is dragged into this and has been into this situation for many years. One wonders whether this is a temporary thing or a structural thing. And what is at the heart of all this is that this is basically a fundamentally an expression of Israeli expansionism and the attempt on the part of Israel to create greater Israel and seize in Lebanon a threat not only militarily. Lebanon is a counterexample. Lebanon is a rich mosaic coexisting. There were some areas and times of instability, but Lebanon has shown that Christians, Muslims, Druze, Jews can all get together and live in peace. And Israel sees in this a threat or a unique experiment of apartheid and the monopoly of one single religious or ethnic group ruling over others. So to a great extent, Lebanon has been a victim of this counter-democratic, despite all the propaganda about being democratic and being able to create a democracy in the Middle East, this is not so. It's literally a Zionist monopoly, apartheid, and a belligerent and violent regime that is basically trying to assert its supremacy and hegemony at the expense of others.
That's been, by the way, I should have framed that to include the issue of Palestine-Gaza. There is, what you just described, my understanding is there has never been, from the Israeli side, a clear and legal commitment to a border. Is that right?
Yeah, that's absolutely. Israel doesn't have a map. And one of the major issues about what's happening now is Lebanon has an armistice agreement that was concluded in 1948 that ended the struggle between Lebanon and Israel and is now completely forgotten and dismissed. And many Lebanese are completely worried. Why can't we refer back to this agreement organize the relationship between the two countries and not to impose on Lebanon a new agreement that is absolutely untenable and in many respects rejected by the majority of Lebanese.
Mm-hmm. Well, the current situation is has become very murky. Because of this encounter, this heavy assault on Iran, at one point Trump declaring that it was over, that he had murdered the leader of, leaders, plural, of the Islamic Republic, and therefore the people were going to rise up, etc. And it seemed at that time that Lebanon shifted over into kind of an alignment with that kind of perspective. But when Iran responded and proved to be resilient, it seems to be in flux with sharp differences. And I'd like you to, of course, maybe I'm wrong about the sharp difference, but it looks as though the design of the Lebanese state is very much under pressure. Could you explain this matter of the, is it, what is they call confessional system involving Shia, Christians, Sunni, and how those elements are reacting to the current crisis?
Yes. Well, first of all, let's dismiss the proposition that Israel is now in Lebanon because Hezbollah rallied to and responded to Israeli positions and bombardment of the north because of the attack on Iran. Well, Israel has been attacking Lebanon continuously before that and has killed scores of Lebanese. And we have examples of many times when Israel has invaded and destroyed many villages and murdered thousands of Lebanese when Hezbollah did not exist. Hezbollah actually came into being in 1982, but Israel has attacked Lebanon in 1973, 1976, 1981, 1982. I mean, there were many cases where Israel has attacked Lebanon when even Hezbollah did not exist.
And they've always been in Lebanese airspace without anybody even mentioning.
Yeah, I mean, thousands. I mean, this morning, as we are talking, I am really disturbed. They have bombed a civilian house and killed a school principal in Nabatiya, a friend of mine that I know. Mm-hmm. And this really bothers me to a great extent, despite the fact that we have a ceasefire agreement. What assurance can the Lebanese ever have that if they conclude an agreement with Israel, they would restrain it, they would stop it, they would constrain it from this encroachment? It's occupying today a huge area of Lebanon. Mm-hmm. And it's bombarding not only southern Lebanon, but Beirut and different areas. And not only what they say, Hezbollah areas. No, not necessarily. Many people would know Lebanon, their areas of Lebanon, Hazmiya, Abda, the area Sa'diyat, they're bombarded. And these are not areas where Hezbollah is any presence of dominance or being a majority. It probably didn't even exist in these areas. Now, one thing you mentioned and is important. Yeah, Lebanese system, unfortunately, is a confessional system in a sense that we have 18 confessions and that some of the positions in government and the public service and the army and the parliament are allocated according to this formula that brings representation for every single sect. We all would like to see a situation where we have a secular system and that this democracy will be wide open and is not apportioned to this. But one thing that is absolutely worrisome about this is that the Lebanese government and to some extent some areas and political areas and political parties. Think of the Shiites, who are the majority in the south, and a large segment of the Lebanese society. I would hazard a guess that they're probably above 30-35%, if not 40% of the total population of Lebanon. And there are lots of Christians and Druze and Muslims who feel very strongly about their brotherhood with this community, and feel that we are all Lebanese. These people have expressed this very willingly. And the worrisome here is that they treat these people as if they are not part of the Lebanese mosaic, when they actually they are, and they are represented in the parliament, in government, and there's incredible intermarriages and communal relationships. This is something that is quite worrisome, that it's a violation of this general accommodation and principle of coexistence. And the Israelis are banking, and what is absolutely an issue that need to be investigated is to what extent the Israelis have their hand into fomenting internal strife and trying to create conditions that would rekindle the civil war that we had, the devastating civil war that we had between 1975 and 1990 in Lebanon. And the issue here is that there is the worrisome question about whatever negotiations taking place now, as if this large majority of Lebanese in the south and in the country are being literally excluded from voicing their concern and their disagreement with any accommodation that would give the enemy that is murdering Lebanese. They just, between the 2nd of March and now, there was a ceasefire agreement. 4,300 and more Lebanese have been murdered. 12,500 have been wounded. 1,200,000 Lebanese were made refugees in their country. They were evacuated every day. If you're in Lebanon, the Israeli command comes with the order. You people in these villages, you are in danger of being killed. Evacuate. I mean, this is literally a international crime. It's a crime against humanity. No party, even in context of war, is permitted and sanctioned to create this collective punishment on civilians and to render them refugees and destroy and literally raise their homes and gardens and cemeteries and churches and mosques to the ground.
By the way, isn't it so that Canada, UK, US, I guess France, have contributed mightily to the problem, have they not, by regarding the organization called Hezbollah, giving it the label terrorist, which, by the way, they hand these things out like candy. If so-and-so is a terrorist, he's a terrorist, this guy's a terrorist. Syria's, you know, has terrorists. But Hezbollah runs for office, does it not? It's it is actually part of the democratic institutions of Lebanon.
Yes.
How did they get away with this kind of labeling?
It's totally unacceptable. And look, it's international law that gives people the right to defend themselves. I mean, they have a responsibility, and they are exercising it to defy and resist an occupier who is occupying their land, destroying their homes, killing their children. Thousands of young children and women have been killed, civilians who have nothing to do with anything at all about this conflict, and yet they're drawn into it and punished by the Israelis, and the world is literally oblivious and quiet and silent. There are some statements, yeah, it's not really acceptable by France and Belgium, Slovenia and Italy and others, but here people need to stop and rein the Israelis. Even Trump, who pretended that he was trying to raid the Israelis, and as you could easily see, the agreement, as you really mentioned, with Iran, one of the memorandum of understanding points is that Israel would cease its occupation of Lebanon and would not harm the Lebanese people. And this is something that Israel has not accepted, complied with, and continues to infringe on the Lebanese and visit on them the violence and upheaval that we witness every day.
Yeah, and from the Israeli point of view, haven't they taken the view, and people speak with this almost as neo-colonial stance, that what they that for the Lebanese to be army to be permitted to move to the south, it has to be under Israeli supervision, basically, and oversight. Isn't that how they view it?
Absolutely, and this is what's probably most worrisome, and what one may consider to be anomaly of this negotiations going on, in the sense that they're tying the Israeli occupation to disarming Hezbollah. Why don't you tie it to international law, to international principles, to the sovereignty of Lebanon that is guaranteed by the UN and every international legal precedent and rule? No, they're tying it to disarming the Hezbollah, which may foment a civil war. I mean, you know, Lebanese are now given the choice. Either Israel will kill you or you should kill yourself. That's totally unacceptable.
Yeah, I guess I should ask, I noticed at the funeral of Ayatollah Khamenei, it's reported, maybe it's wrong, I'd have to ask you, with the defense minister of Lebanon was present, and a representation of a group called Amal and Hezbollah. Just as an assessment, what does that tell you? Who is the defense minister? Why, and what is Lebanon's current position on the Islamic Republic? Because they were expelling or certainly treating representatives of Iran very coldly. What is the current relations?
Well, I mean, there are friendly relationships. There are some segments of the Lebanese polity that are not happy about it, but the two countries have ambassadors and have legal and diplomatic relations. And as you easily can see, that there is a large group of Lebanon who believe in, you know, who are Shiites, and they share a common religious beliefs and practices with the Iranians. And it's quite normal. The Speaker of the Parliament is a Shiite, Mr. Nabi Birri, and he is not, he has an Amal group, which is not a part of Hezbollah, but they are not enemies. They have lots of cordial relationships.
Well, by the way, could I ask you, and by the way, we're speaking to Professor Atif Kaborsi, who is an authority, and we're very fortunate to have him. What is Amal? I notice that they're now beginning to discuss once again Nabi Berri. His name is coming up more and more. What is his take on these negotiations with the U.S. and Israel and all that? Is he changing his views at all, or what's he saying?
No. He has always been an ally. He was not member of Hezbollah. I mean, they are two different groups, but they share incredible relationships and support, and he feels responsible for the Shiites, which Hezbollah is, you know, most of the members are members of this sect. So Hezbollah and Amal are to be seen as allies, and Nabih Berri has, to a great extent...
Are they rejecting the Aoun attempt to get a deal that would please Trump? Are they critical, or what did they say?
Yeah, they're critical. They're saying that, first of all, you are not bringing the agreement to the parliament as the law and the constitution would demand.
That's very important. They're afraid to take it to the people?
Yeah, exactly. And that's exactly what the story is, because any agreement to be binding, especially critical, strategic, existential agreement of the sort with an enemy that is killing your people, it needs to garner 2/3 majority in the parliament. And Nabih Berri, who is the Speaker of the House, he is very unhappy about an agreement being concluded or negotiated outside the parliament and outside the constitutional framework that requires a 2/3 majority agreement.
That I'm really glad we're talking about this. By the way, I think we should, I'm sure you're aware of it, Trump is always telling everybody, he just reaches in his pocket and reads from notes, and I've got this, I've got that, and it's all done. Which the American, by the way, the U.S. Congress is beginning to ask, how do you do all these things and you don't come to us? But more importantly, my understanding is that the leadership of the Islamic Republic at this time are saying, yes, these are the terms we're going to go for, we want this agreement, but it will have to go to our parliament. And nobody's mentioning, but that means that this evil regime of mullahs, as people like to say here, propagandists, they actually do have a parliament, and that parliament expects to review any agreement.
Absolutely, and that's exactly what the Lebanese, who are feeling unhappy about this agreement that is being negotiated and may really go to the point of trying to implement it when it has not been done through what the Constitution requires, to go through Parliament and receive 2/3 majority from the representatives.
It's really remarkable. I wish, and I'm really glad we're talking to you about this, because these matters don't get underlined. The base, you know, someone saying, what is the foundation, the legal foundation, the democratic foundation of any agreement? And they just assume, well, it's Mr. Aoun, or it's Mr. Trump, or it's Bibi Netanyahu. No. It's a little more complicated.
A lot more complicated.
Yes, a lot more.
Yeah, and what's worrisome, Finn?
Of course, dangerous.
Yeah, what's even worse is that these negotiations are conducted in Lebanon with a complete dismissal of what we consider to be the appropriate way of negotiating. Look, Lebanese are getting into this and trying to dismantle the only resistance and any credible force that could prevent the Israelis and could stand up to the Israeli aggression. You don't enter a bargain with your hands tied behind your back and surrender everything. You enter with your hands behind your back, so you don't make concessions. Lebanese are coming into this negotiation, and that's why many Lebanese are raising questions about it and trying to do concessions that are totally inappropriate. Iran offered Lebanon a support that the Lebanese government is turning its back on it. Why would the Lebanese government completely turn its back on the call by the Iranians that any agreement they have with the U.S. should include reigning Israel, preventing it from doing havoc and destruction and death in Lebanon, and to respect and abide by the international law about the sovereignty of Lebanon and to withdraw its occupying force.
Yes. And there's this game being played there that, and of course it's one of the oldest political games in North America, but, well, in Europe actually, to play this, to argue the back and forth between Israel as autonomous or and the U.S. It's like, I think we've used the analogy, it's like tag team in wrestling. One of them attacks and gets in trouble, and the other one jumps in. And it seems to me that the Iran position is to eliminate that possibility by saying, we have to talk about your friend. You can't just talk to, we can't have an agreement if you're going to allow your friend to attack us.
Exactly. And this is absolutely quite worrisome, is that the asymmetry here and the biases that are unfolding. Oh, Israel has the right to protect itself. What about the right of the Palestinians to protect
themselves? How about Lebanon's right?
And Lebanese to protect themselves. Oh, come on. I mean, the world has to be a bit more open, equitable, recognize the rights of others. You cannot just assert your right by force. This is a jungle rule. We need to be back into the fold and the preview of international law, international humanitarian law, and agreements and constitutions.
Well, also, how about the UN Charter and the fact that Lebanon is a member of the United Nations? I think it was one of the original member, weren't they?
Yes.
Now, you have two nuclear powers talking about a country, Iran, that doesn't have nuclear weapons and how it's very important that they not have it. So why can't Lebanon and Iran say, why does Israel have nuclear weapons? They're not a member of any international non-proliferation treaty. If we're going to talk about our not having weapons to defend ourselves, why do they have that weapon?
Yeah, I mean, one thing that is quite legitimate to raise here is why should any country has a nuclear weapon to begin with, especially that has not really been willing to sign the non-proliferation agreement, and then other countries who are worried about them being attacked by these countries to have the means of symmetrical, what you call mutual, assured mutual destruction, so that you constrain the others from feeling that they can use weapons of destruction against you.
Yeah. No, it's bizarre. To me, the bizarre point is that they don't. Well, at various times in the past, there have been the Association of Arab States and Islamic States have said rhetorically, but softly, this region should be a nuclear-free zone. But then they dropped the subject. But it seems to me, at this point in history, with the situation becoming more dangerous, that should be on the table. There should be a nuclear exclusion zone, that the parties are equal.
Absolutely. I mean, I am a strong advocate of having this region nuclear free. You cannot have one party because it's an invitation for every other party to acquire this. And I don't think there is anything really acceptable or engendering peace under this situation. It creates the incentive of every party that's denied to have the weapon from having it. And we're seeing examples, what happened in India and Pakistan and other parties. This is a time which may be opportune time to start talking about a nuclear-free Middle East.
Yeah. I wish there was some leadership on that point. But it's coming, by the way, we were speaking to Professor Atif Kaboursi, Professor Emeritus McMaster University, and has worked in the region for both United Nations and other parties. You've noted something about Syria. I think we ought to, if you have the time, I'd like to talk to you about it. That is, Syria has gone through a very quick and extraordinary kind of process, and I don't know where it stands now, but it when Lebanon is discussed, Syria is usually part of the discussion, and in the old days, Syria was somehow part of the solution. They were their troops were once in Lebanon at the end of the Civil War, I think from 75 to 90, was it? But at any rate, but now, so where does Syria fit into the current situation?
Well, Mr. Trump is trying to persuade Gulani, the new leader of Syria, to enter Lebanon and disarm Hezbollah. I mean, this is as if we don't have enough trouble, but Syrians so far have proven to be a little bit more wise than what Mr. Trump wants them to do, have refused so far to do it. And the issue here is that now Mr. Gulani is going to be welcomed into the NATO summit in Europe, and God knows what the Trump administration...
They're going to be meeting in the next few days, right?
Yeah, they're trying to persuade Gulani to become a party to the conflict. So far, he has resisted. I hope, I'm sure he knows that the Syrian people would not accept Syria joining Israel in attack on Lebanon.
Well, where is this have anything to do with the position of Turkey, Mr. Erdogan? Who is the current Giuliani? Giuliani, that's the mayor of New York. Who is Giuliani listening to? Is it Turkey?
Yeah, Turkey is one of the powers listening to, and he's listening to the rattle of money from Saudi Arabia and to the Americans. The question here is, he should listen to the Syrian people. Syrian people have continuously felt the strong brotherly relationship they have to Lebanon, and I hope they abide by it and would not be dragged or persuaded, seduced into being a party to this conflict.
Would you know if the Syrian leadership media are discussing these matters? Is it apparent to the population, or their opinion, their views are known because historically they have all Syrians realize a special relationship with Lebanon, Beirut. But do you know, are they openly talking about what they want and don't want?
Well, they're not, perfectly, totally open. But you see, Al Jazeera went there and they interviewed people, and they unanimously, the Syrian people are not willing to be dragged into this.
Al Jazeera was republishing that.
Yeah, they published some of the interviews. They were done on the street of Damascus, and without exception, everyone they talked to was totally adamant. We have no intention of being a party to the conflict in Lebanon.
Well, if the leadership allowed those interviews, that's pretty significant to see that expression. And Professor Kaborzi, I want to ask you about this. It was a terrific exchange of force, there is no conclusion really, in my opinion, so far of how this is all going to the aftershock of the encounter between the U.S., Israel, and Iran, but the Gulf states went through an experience, or going through it, because the Islamic Republic says if you have U.S. bases in your country and they attack us, we're going to attack you. We're going to attack those bases, which is true. They haven't attacked the civilian population. They've attacked the bases. But is that changing the outlook of what we call the Gulf states?
Absolutely. Look, the 27 American bases in the Gulf states, and they had more than 50,000 soldiers and things. And they were supposed to protect these states. Ultimately, it was the Gulf states protecting the Americans then. I'm sure the Gulf leaders are reconsidering, reevaluating whether all the amount of money and this reliance on the U.S. has paid off.
Yeah. The Canadians should be listening. We have our umbrella. We're supposed to be protected. That's what the UAE thought, right?
Yes, absolutely. And so did Kuwait, and so did Bahrain, and so did Saudi Arabia. They found out that the Americans were only interested in themselves and that they have failed to live up to the agreement and that the big, huge investments these Gulf countries have paid for these foreign bases.
And now I realize I want to exploit you for one more question. What is the issue of the Iraqi government? They obviously are reacting to this situation as well. And U.S. had quite a bit of hegemony. They built a big embassy. They acted like they owned the place. What's the current position there of Iraq and regarding Islamic Republic?
Well, you know, the majority of people in Iraq are Shiite, and they have an affinity, people to people. And Iraq, to a great extent, and have strong relationships with Iran. But they are in a very difficult position, being, you know, oil-producing in OPEC, being Arab, being Muslim, being things. Iraq is in a difficult bind, but if you ask me what would the majority of the Iraqi people want, they certainly want to have a strong relationship and cordial relationships, and hopefully that this region would learn that its security is by cooperating, not by being at odds with each other and depending on foreign powers that they come to protect them when they have no other objective other than their interests.
Yes, and that adventure of trying to, that the U.S. had of trying to encourage Kurds to cross the border and fight with Iran, that went up in smoke, right?
Yes, absolutely. Went absolutely in smoke. they put the weapons and they never went any place. Look, I mean, the Kurds know very well that and have seen in their eyes that other countries depended on the Americans to protect them. The Kurds have a long history and a large number of experiences where the Americans turned their backs on them.
Yes, they're known for as much as betraying people as supporting. Well, I suppose we should conclude with we hope that all this talk about how to solve Lebanon's problems will end up in front of the Lebanese parliament where it will be properly solved, right?
Absolutely. And this, the Lebanese should insist. And this is a test of their democracy and of their peaceful coexistence among the parties. Yeah. This is not something that one group would have the monopoly and would choose by themselves to do it. This has to come from a general and wide and broad agreement about the people of Lebanon and within the constitutional framework that organizes how these things get settled.
Yeah. Well, Professor Kaboursi, it's always enlightening to speak to you. We're very appreciative. Look forward to talking to you again.
Yeah, my pleasure to talk to you as a time.
Thank you. This is the Taylor Report. It is CIUT 89.5. You might want to hear the Lebanese national anthem, which we will play.